Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. We have new folks that have come in, but we also have folks that have hung around as we're in the pediatric tract room. I want to reintroduce to the stage Dr. Lisa Swanson, who is a board-certified dermatologist and pediatric dermatologist. She practiced in Colorado, and now she's moved to Boise, Ohio, where she is the first and only pediatric dermatologist in the state of Idaho. Did I say another state beside Idaho?
You said Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not uncommon.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, it's like in my map, the whole northern part of the United States is just globbed together, and it's called Ohio.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Yes.
I'm President Bush, ladies and gentlemen. No, didn't he do that, mushing them together? We're also very excited because Dr. Swanson will serve as our 2024 Summer Medical Director in San Diego, which is amazing. As you know, or you'll find out now, she is very practical in her application of how she treats pediatric patients and very in touch with the patient experience, the family experience, which I just think is amazing. So we're delighted to have her lecturing to us on the topic of challenging pediatric dermatology cases.
Thank you. Hello again. So yes, Lisa Swanson back again. And I'll just dive right on in. This talk's a little bit longer than my first talk. And if we don't have a ton of time for questions afterwards, I am doing kind of a pretty open question and answer thing with Doug DiRuggiero after this, because I think we're filling in for a speaker that had to cancel. So trust me, you'll get questions answered. And you can always email me. I include my email address at the beginning and end of all my talks. Feel free to email me. I'm happy to be your phone a friend. During our talk today, we're going to talk about a lot of conditions that really impact a patient's quality of life, really are a burden to them. And so when I was preparing for this, I tried to think, like, what was my burden growing up? You know, we saw my hemangiomas in my previous talk, but I didn't really view those as a huge burden, to be honest. I have no negative memories of them. And so I was like, what did I deal with as a kid that would help me empathize and put myself in the shoes of my patients who are dealing with these chronic inflammatory skin diseases? And it took me a little bit, but then I knew exactly what my burden was. When I was a kid, you guys, I had really fat feet. Really fat. Like, I had to shop at special stores for fat-footed children. And I was never confident of my footwear. I was always just wearing whatever fit at the special store for fat-footed kids. And my high school boyfriend, to put this into perspective for you guys, my high school boyfriend called me Hooves because my feet were as long as they were wide. Yeah. And so when we got married, just kidding. But I was never proud of my footwear. And one day, I was in the store with my mom, and I saw this pair of pink, sparkly cowboy boots. I grew up in Arizona. And I was like, Mom, I need those boots. And she said, okay, try them on. If they fit you, I'll buy them for you. She's thinking, there is no way on God's green earth that my fat-footed daughter is going to get her hoof in that boot. But I'll tell you what, you guys, they slipped on like Cinderella's slipper. A shoe has never felt that good. And when I was in my pink sparkly cowboy boots, I could rule the world. My self-esteem was here. My confidence was here. Everything was great. And so I try in my clinics to make my patients feel like they're wearing a pair of pink sparkly cowboy boots. Metaphorically, of course, because not everybody can pull them off the way that I can, because I really rocked them. But metaphorically make them feel like they're in a pair of pink sparkly cowboy boots. And so this is me as a kid for one of my school pictures, and it's an okay day. I'm okay. I'm feeling okay about my footwear on this day, but there were bad days like this one. You can tell I'm really not loving those moccasins. Look at my face. That tells you the whole story. And then this is me on a pink sparkly boot day. I know, right? It's everything. I asked my mom, of course, my mom threw them away, which she does admit now was a mistake. She should have had them like bronzed or preserved in glass or something like that, but she threw them away. And so I said, Mom, do you have any pictures of my pink sparkly cowboy boots? And she said, oh, shoot, no. And then I said, I was the shortest person in my class, like, every year. And you know how they line you up for class photos in order of height? So I was always in the front row. I was like, Mom, look at my class photos. Maybe you'll find them. And she did. So I was very happy for that. Okay, This presentation is also in case format, so I hope you guys get a lot out of it. This is case number one, cute little three-year-old girl that has a several-month history of this bad rash all over her. And this is psoriasis, pediatric psoriasis in this little kiddo. It's important when you see psoriasis in a little kiddo to do a strep test, because strep can be a trigger that sets it off. You have to treat the strep, but treating the strep doesn't cure the psoriasis. It's just if you don't treat the strep, it's really hard to get the psoriasis under control. So you have to check for strep. Hers was negative. Treated with triamcinolone with minimal improvement, then I started some heavier lifting topicals, didn't do anything. And the patient's daycare was calling the family every day about this rash. Like, what are you guys doing about this? We're afraid it's contagious to the other kids. Like, making the parents feel really bad. And the parents were like, we're trying, trust me, we're trying. And I was like, I'm trying, trust me, I'm trying. But we couldn't make it improve. So I went ahead and started methotrexate because she's 3 years old. There's no biologic agent that's approved in her age group. And so I was like, okay, this is one situation where I'll go ahead and start methotrexate. She still failed to improve. So we went ahead and started ustekinumab, and I'll show you photos of that. I want to emphasize that pediatric psoriasis is out there. It's out there, it's increasing in its prevalence, and it's being misdiagnosed every day. Not so much in the derm sphere, but in primary care, the world of primary care, it's getting misdiagnosed as eczema and fungus and all sorts of other things. When I started in practice 13 and a half years ago, I would see one new pediatric patient a month with psoriasis, and nowadays I see one every day. And it's been that way for the past 5 to 6 years. It was true in Colorado, it's been true in Idaho. So pediatric psoriasis is on the rise. We don't know why, but it's out there. Be on the lookout for it, especially like inverse psoriasis in the underwear area. That gets called yeast over and over and over again by primary care doctors. And I'll see kids that have been on like oral antifungals for months at a time without improvement. And then finally they send them to me and it's psoriasis. Psoriasis is a systemic disease. We understand this now. The inflammation is not just in the skin, it's everywhere, and it increases our rates for certain comorbid diseases, and that's true also in our pediatric patient population, and so this should be on your radar that it's important to manage it, talk to patients about it, treat it. The relationship of this burden disease to the treatment paradigm, I think there's a lot of us who feel that treating a systemic disease systemically makes a whole lot of sense. We might be able to thwart this psoriatic march of inflammation, especially if we're treating a child. So we might be able to prevent those downstream consequences by earlier treatment and treating systemically. The incidence of comorbidities in patients younger than 20 with psoriasis is twice that of people who don't have psoriasis. So this is something that very much is an important thing. Another thing, we think that treating with systemic agents will reduce the incidence of these comorbidities. We have a couple of studies that show us that that assumption is likely correct. One of them was on ustekinumab. It was just 10 patients, so a small trial. But what they did was they looked at PET CT scan as a measure of inflammation in various places. And apparently the aortic root is a correlated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And so they looked at this inflammation in various places and they put them on ustekinumab and they followed that over time. And over a year on ustekinumab, the inflammation reduced by 19%. In 1 year, imagine what we can do over time. There was another article that looked at psoriasis patients on Humira. These were adult patients, and they looked at all-cause mortality for these patients. And they said, okay, over a 10-year period, we would expect 144 deaths to occur in this patient population. How many people died? And the answer was 60. A 58% lower mortality rate. And the tagline of the article was, you can save lives by treating psoriasis, which I really like and really identify with. We have four biologics that are approved in the pediatric space. We have etanercept down to age 4, and then ustekinumab, ixekizumab, and secukinumab down to age 6. And that's wonderful. And others are on the way, they're being evaluated, and they're on the way, which is great. Now that we have two IL-17 inhibitors approved in the pediatric space, this question of potential risk for IBD becomes a bigger question. These kids often haven't had time to develop symptoms or kind of show that they have IBD. So how do we manage that? Well, speaking with pediatric gastroenterologists, I came up with a list of 4 screening questions and 3 screening labs to consider when you're considering these IL-17 inhibitors. So ask about family history of IBD. Ask about growth issues. One of the most common ways that Crohn's presents in kids is kids are falling off the growth curve. And the number one associated comorbidity for pediatric psoriasis is obesity. So if you're seeing a kiddo with psoriasis and they're falling off growth curves, that's definitely a reason to be suspicious that there's something else going on. Nocturnal diarrhea, nocturnal bowel movements are a common symptom. And then perianal symptoms like pain when going to the bathroom, blood on the toilet paper, etc. Screening tests, if you want to. This is what I do. It's not mandatory. It's not in the package insert, but this is what I do to try to assure myself that I'm doing everything in my power to watch out for IBD. You do a CBC to evaluate for anemia. You do a CRP. If all you have is psoriasis, your CRP should be normal, but it's elevated in situations of psoriatic arthritis, obesity, and simmering inflammatory bowel disease. And then a fecal calprotectin level. How many people in this room have ordered a fecal calprotectin level? Okay, a handful. By next year, I bet all the hands in this room will go up. This is a great test. It's a test done on a stool sample. It has great specificity and sensitivity. The cost is good. Insurance coverage is good. It's well covered. And if it's elevated, there's a high likelihood the patient has simmering inflammatory bowel disease. There have been articles in our literature questioning, should we be doing this on all our psoriasis patients? Should we be doing this on all our HS patients because of the comorbidity of inflammatory bowel disease? So it's an easy test. It's a non-invasive test. Calprotectin is something that's secreted by neutrophils in the GI tract. So when it's elevated, that means your neutrophils are really pumping out. You have a lot of neutrophils. They're pumping out inflammatory markers. Don't be afraid to treat kids with bad psoriasis. These kids are people too, and they need to look better and feel better also. And this lesson was taught to me by my patient, Lauren. So Lauren was one of my Colorado patients, and she was, gosh, this was years ago, she was probably 7 or 8 years old, and she had horrible psoriasis, just horrible psoriasis. And I tried everything, all sorts of topicals, we had a home light unit, and we just couldn't get her looking good. And so one day I was about to go into an explanation of the options of methotrexate and cyclosporin. And I had an epiphany. I was like, why am I about to present these substandard treatment options to this patient and her family purely because of her age? And so when I talked to her and her family that day, I told them about methotrexate and cyclosporin, but I also told them about etanercept and Eustachian and UMAP that had some pediatric data at the time. And Lauren herself was like, she heard about Eustachian and UMAP and she's like, that's the one I want. That's the one I want to be on. And so we started it and she did great. And she was still on it when I moved away from Colorado. I assume she's still on it now. And it was really wonderful to see her come out of her shell being treated for her psoriasis with the Eustachian and UMAP. About a year into treatment, Lauren, her mom and her dad came in for her shot. She gets her shot and she and her mom start leaving the room and her dad kind of hung back. And he said, I just want you to know how much of an impact you've made on all of our lives. And we're so grateful that you came into our lives to help us with this. And as my eyes filled with tears, I thought 2 things. Number one, I hope they leave a positive review on Yelp, because that would really help my average. Number two, it's experiences like this that it's why we do what we do, to have these experiences to help our patients feel better, live better, do better, and it's wonderful when that happens. This is Derek and Dylan. They're twins. They were 16 at the time of this photo, and Derek and Dylan were like erythrodermic with psoriasis, head to toe, and they had been treated with intermittent IM Kenalog shots and buckets of triamcinolone. They came to me just head to toe psoriasis. And prior to seeing me, Derek and Dylan, they just kind of kept to themselves. You know, they're twins, so they're kind of friends, and they didn't have friends outside of their twinmanship, and they didn't do sports, and they didn't participate in extracurricular activities. They just kind of hung out with themselves. And so we made the decision to get them on biologic therapy, and 6 months into treatment, they sent me this photo. They were going to prom, and not only did they have dates, they had actual girlfriends, which is amazing, knowing Derek and Dylan as I did. And so you can really change some lives by treating pediatric psoriasis. Which brings us back to Evelyn. So Evelyn had failed topicals, failed methotrexate. We got her on ustekinumab. This was the day of her first ustekinumab shot. This was the one, 1 month later, she really likes suckers, like every picture of her sucker in her mouth. So this was 1 month in, and this was when she got her third shot, 4 months in. Just wonderful. And she said, the first thing she said when I walked in, she said, Dr. Swanson, my ouchies are gone. My ouchies are gone. And daycare isn't complaining anymore about her psoriasis, which is great. Moving on to case number two. This little girl, 2 years old, never a history of skin problems in her life until 2 weeks prior when she started breaking out with all these blisters everywhere. Her pediatrician had swabbed her for bacteria, had started her on prednisone, but it wasn't doing anything. So I took a look at her and I said, okay, I know the diagnosis. This is chronic bullous disease of childhood. It presented pretty classically. All of a sudden, these rings of blisters, arms, legs, underwear area, face, it all fit. I was like, this is chronic bullous disease of childhood. Now, the treatment of choice for CBDC is dapsone. So I did the baseline blood work. I did the G6PD. All was normal, and we started dapsone. 5 days into it, mom called and said, I don't know her coloring. There's something a bit off with her coloring. And so I said, come on in. We'll take a look. There was definitely something off with her coloring. She was blue. Sent her for labs immediately, met hemoglobin level 20.9, normal is less than 1. She had met hemoglobinemia from her dapsone. I had never seen it before. It's on a lot of exams when you're going through training, but I had never actually seen it, and here it was. So she had to be admitted to the PICU for methylene blue. Even more, yeah, I felt like crawling under the covers and eating Velveeta right out of the box in that situation, because oh my gosh, that's not what I wanted to do. Also, we have her skin disease. So not only she gets released from the PICU, she said she peed blue for 2 weeks. But now we still have her chronic bullous disease of childhood to deal with. How are we going to treat this? Now the textbooks would say that your next option is cyclosporin or CellCept. And both of those options felt super scary now after having gone through the methemoglobinemia situation. And so I sent out an email to my peds derm phone a friend circle. And I told them the story and I said, what would you guys do? And about 10 people replied. 9 of them said they would do cyclosporin or CellCept, whichever one was their favorite. And one respondent said, I don't know, I think I would try dupilumab. And so I talked it over with the family, gave them the options. I said, Dupi is nice because we don't have to do blood work. It's a very safe medication. It's approved down to the age of 6 months. The worst thing that could happen is it might not work. Chronic bullous disease of childhood is considered a neutrophilic skin disorder, and dupilumab helps with eosinophilic skin disorders. So it might not work, but from a safety perspective, very appealing. So they made the decision to go ahead and start Dupi. And so this is the day that we started dupilumab. She was really sad that day. She's a cute little girl. She kept a positive outlook most of the time, but this was 2 weeks later. So I dosed her at 300 milligrams every 2 weeks because I just wanted her to get better so badly. And I view dupilumab as being so safe. And I really wanted to give her the best chance for quick improvement. And so I dosed her at 300 milligrams every 2 weeks. And so this was her when she came in for her second dose. She did have some MRSA incidentally on her neck. This was 1 month on Dupi. And this was 2 months on Dupi. She's still on Dupi now, although we're considering starting to taper her because now she's nearly 5, and kids tend to outgrow CBDC. And so we're thinking about starting to taper her. So lessons learned from this case, rare things happen, methemoglobinemia from dapsone, and get a little help from your friends. Not any of us know everything. We all need to reach out to the people that help us for ideas on how to manage stuff. Case number 3. This is an 8-year-old boy who presented for discoloration on the left cheek for the past few months. He had been treated with ketoconazole cream from his PCP without any improvement. And this is him, and this is Lincoln. And Lincoln has segmental vitiligo affecting the left cheek, left nose, left lower eyelid, left upper cutaneous lip. And so I said, you know, you're 8. And this is segmental vitiligo, but I really want to treat you with topical ruxolitinib because I think it works the best of our treatments for vitiligo, especially on the face, the sun-exposed areas. And so I gave him samples since I was off-label in both ways, but his improvement was great. I did also recommend Polypodium leucotomus, brand name HelioCare. I always combine that with topical rux for vitiligo, and it's because we know topical rux works better with light, and we know that light therapy works better with Polypodium leucotomus. It's counterintuitive because we use HelioCare to protect our skin from the sun, but there are several studies showing that it makes light therapy work better for things like psoriasis and vitiligo. So I build upon those things, and I put all my patients on topical rux on HelioCare as well. And HelioCare is safe down to any age. They're capsules, but you can open them up, sprinkle the powder on something or in juice. I find it particularly helpful for light-sensitive conditions like polymorphous light eruption, dermatomyositis, lupus. I use it a lot for those things. So I got him started on both of those things, and this is him over time. So baseline, middle picture is 2 months in, right picture is 5 months in. And I said to him, I was like, Lincoln, your improvement is like so amazing, but in each picture you get sadder. Like, why so glum, chum? You know, like, we're making your vitiligo better. And his dad said, no, he's really happy with the vitiligo. He's just not a morning person. And the times when he looks sadder were visits in the morning. And so he is very happy with his improvement. Topical rux really works great, especially on the face. This was another patient of mine who was actually the mother of a couple patients I was seeing. And I said, oh, I noticed that you deal with a little bit of vitiligo. She started crying. People had been really mean to her about it, a lot of whom were her family members. And I told her about topical rux. I got her on the treatment. This was her 3 months later. And she said, you gave me my face back. You gave me my life back. We can really make a big impact on these patients and finally get them some improvement for their vitiligo. Two things that I tell all patients when I prescribe topical rux. I say there are two things that are special about the safety of this medicine. Number one, less than 20% BSA when you're treating atopic dermatitis, less than 10% BSA when you're treating vitiligo. Why the difference? Well, the people who create the rules for these things thought that that was the more appropriate way to go because with vitiligo, you're requiring chronic twice a day application. It can take a year to get success. They have data showing patients achieving success after 2 years of applying it. So you know you're in for a longer haul, whereas the application for atopic dermatitis is intermittent and spot treatment. And so they felt with something that was being applied chronically to lower the BSA treated area made some sense. So that's how they came up with that. And then I also tell them that there's a black box warning on these JAK inhibitors. I explain that there's a family of medicines called JAK inhibitors. Most of them are pills. Topical rux is the only topical medicine. And because of some safety concerns that stemmed from one of the studies on one of the oral agents called Xeljanz, the FDA put the boxed warning on all members of that family, even our topical ruxolitinib. And I say, in a way, topical ruxolitinib is a bit like Kendall Jenner. She's low drama, but she's in the same family as Kim and Chloe and Courtney and Kylie, higher drama. And that's all I really need to say. My safety conversation with folks for topical rux is super easy peasy, because as soon as I say that, they're like, oh yeah, I get it. I totally get it. Case number four. This is another 8-year-old boy that comes in with his dad for 3 warts on the right elbow. Dad demanded that I treat them with liquid nitrogen because it worked for him when he was a kid. I explained that liquid nitrogen hurts, has a success rate of about 30 to 50%, and I believe that there are better options out there. I also explained that you have to treat warts several times with liquid nitrogen. It's rarely a one and done sort of situation. And I told him about wart peel. How many people in this room have heard of wart peel? Yes. How many people heard of it from me? Yeah. I love wort peel. Wort peel, best thing ever. Salicylic acid and 5-FU in a proprietary medium. It's available through a pharmacy in Iowa called NewCara. Each of their locations is responsible for shipping to different states, and so you can look on their website to find out which location is your location. But this stuff is magic in a bottle. Works 98% of the time. Doesn't hurt. Works fast. Typically 3 weeks, you've got your warts gone. It costs $99. The pharmacy doesn't deal with insurance at all. It is worth every penny. A couple before and after pictures. This is just 2 weeks using topical wart peel. It's great around the nail. Often when you're in the midst of treatment, it'll cause a little bit of onycholysis, but it fixes itself, no problema. One trick with wart peel, you don't have to treat every single wart. You can just treat a few and get the immune system triggered to treat the rest. So I see a lot of kids who will have warts on their hands and then also on their face. I just treat their hands with wart peel and then the face ones respond because the immune system gets rid of them. So you can just focus your efforts on a few and get all of them to go away by triggering the immune system. Some patients will come back in and say, "You lied, Dr. Swanson, the wart peel didn't work." And I always say, "Tell me what happened. What did you notice?" And the most common thing they'll say is that we were using it, it seemed to be helping, and then we stopped. And they either stop because A, they think the wart's gone, or B, it starts getting irritating, and so they stop. My theory, wart peel has two key ingredients, salicylic acid and 5-FU. The salicylic acid works in a destructive way. The 5-FU works in an immune system triggering way. And I think sometimes patients get a lot more destruction at the beginning. And so you get that superficial irritation. And then they think the wart's gone or it starts causing some burning and stinging. And so they stop. But the immune system triggering properties haven't had time to kick in. And so I will do a slow simmer where they just apply it Monday, Wednesday, Friday at bedtime to allow more time for immune system response. And the slow simmer, when I've done the slow simmer after somebody fails wart peel, it typically always works. So slow simmer Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Can you use wart peel on the face? Well, you're not supposed to put it right on the eyelids or in the nose or in the mouth, but you can use it on other facial skin. I do modify the instructions. So I tell them just a teeny dab with a Q-tip Monday, Wednesday, Friday at bedtime, no sticky tape. So I do modify the instructions in that way. So it can be very good for things like flat warts. And again, you don't have to treat all of them. Treat a few, let the immune system respond. Case number 5. So this little boy, 5-year-old boy, presented for atopic dermatitis. It was really, really bad. He had had eczema his whole life, but the past year or two had been really, really bad. He had been getting oral immunotherapy through a functional medicine provider in town, and he was miserable. My first visit with him, he was just pacing the room. He was so uncomfortable. He was just pacing the room. He was shivering because when you're erythrodermic from atopic dermatitis, you have no skin barrier and you lose heat. So he was shivering, pacing the room, so, so uncomfortable. He complained that he couldn't play outside. He couldn't go swimming because his skin hurt too bad. He had tried and failed a couple of topical steroids, and so clearly we needed to move on from there. A couple things about atopic dermatitis in general. We're learning that early baby life matters when it comes to who develops atopic dermatitis. So there was one study a few years ago that showed that if you moisturize, they used Vaseline, if you moisturize your babies from day one of life, you have a 50% lower incidence of atopic dermatitis. And everybody was like, whoa, that's awesome. And so a second study was done to try to confirm that, and it didn't show any benefit. A third study was done, and it showed some benefit, but not to the same degree as the initial study. I think using emollients early on in life is an easy strategy to recommend to folks so that they can hopefully prevent some atopic dermatitis. The microbiome, we know it's playing some sort of role. If a pregnant woman takes oral probiotics a month before she has the baby to 3 months after she has the baby, it reduces the risk of eczema in the baby by 25 to 30%. And that's an easy thing to do, right? An oral probiotic. So these are easy recommendations to make. We also think that flora plays a role because the longer you stay in the NICU as a baby, the lower your incidence of atopic dermatitis. Oral antibiotic exposure the first month of life, especially week 2, lowers your risk of atopic dermatitis. We know that there's something happening with flora, both on our skin and in our GI tract. We don't understand all the ins and the outs, and we're not gonna keep babies in NICUs. We're not gonna give all babies oral antibiotics. But these trends are giving us clues as to what matters, and hopefully one day we will be able to provide meaningful and appropriate instruction to reduce the risk of atopic dermatitis. The two things I tell people about nowadays, I tell them about the oral probiotics for the mom and moisturize your baby. Sometimes, so there's this comedy on FX called Dave, and it's a little bit of a raunchy show, but in the very first episode, he said something very quotable. you should know that there is a big disconnect between the online medical community and the brick and mortar establishment. And I think that's never more true than in the world of atopic dermatitis, because it's just crazy. And so many people want to blame food for their child's eczema. This is something I talk about every single day, multiple times a day. And I tell them, I wish it was food. My life would be so much easier if I could just tell you to avoid eggs for your baby and everything will be totally fine. I wish it was, but it typically is not. 98% of the time, it's not. This article here is a really great article. It's a recent publication, good group of folks on it, both from the allergy world and the dermatology world. And I keep copies of it in my office in case patients want more information about this as something that I can hand them as a resource. But we know that kids with atopic dermatitis have increased risk of allergies, including food allergies, but those allergies are not driving the eczema. When there is a direct correlation, you're going to know it. They're going to see a reaction within 30 minutes of eating said food. If you're not noticing that time correlation, there is not a direct cause and effect relationship. I've heard a couple allergists say that food allergy is a clinical diagnosis. You hear a story, you're like, man, that sounds like an allergy. And I think that is so true. It is important to send severe eczema patients to an allergist before the age of 6 months to rule out peanut allergy, because they're at increased risk, and talk to them about how to introduce it, which we'll also talk about here. We don't recommend elimination diets. The kids need their nutrition. It rarely helps, and avoidance is actually linked to an increased risk of food allergy. Introducing peanut, an allergist at a talk I was at gave this very nice overview of how to safely introduce peanut to reduce the risk of peanut allergy. So introduce at 6 months old, mix a little bit in formula or breast milk, give the child a sip, wait 30 minutes. If everything goes okay, then they can finish that bottle and they can have it 3 times a week. Now, the one exception is the kids with severe atopic dermatitis. They should see an allergist first to be tested and then talk about proper introduction. So that's a little bit of an exception. There's also growing research that shows that the atopic dermatitis is likely the cause of the food allergy. And so the theory is that aerosolized food particles are able to enter the skin through the broken skin barrier, interact with the immune system in an abnormal way, which triggers allergy. And so the best thing you can do to reduce your child's risk for food allergy is treat your child's atopic dermatitis. And again, avoiding foods can be harmful. There was also a study recently published in our Peds Germ Journal looking at the incidence of food allergies in patients with facial atopic dermatitis compared to kids who didn't have facial involvement. And they found a higher rate of food sensitization in the kids with facial involvement, which lends itself to the theory that it's these aerosolized particles getting unfettered access to the skin and interacting with the immune system to create allergy. There was also a small study out of Japan that looked at patients with atopic dermatitis under the age of 2. And they treated half of them and they didn't treat half of them, and they found a lower incidence of food allergy in the treated group. So again, the best thing you can do, treat your child's atopic dermatitis. Sometimes when I'm interacting with AD families, I feel like Leslie Knope in the episode of Parks and Recreation where she's trying to convince people they don't need the big buckets of sugary soda. And she said, all I have on my side is facts and science. And people hate facts and science. How many of you guys feel that way when you're interacting with some of these eczema families? Oh my gosh, it's so hard. And it's because there's so much stuff out there that they get exposure to. Amazon, if you Google like eczema cream on Amazon, it's insane all the things that they offer and the cost of it all. Oh my gosh. This was one product that got really great reviews that I just have a couple questions about. I don't think I have a pointer, but you can see that in the orange, in the big picture, it describes itself as mildly earthy. What does that mean? Is there dirt in it? Like, what on earth? How do they make that claim? And then you see the 5-star review. This product cleared my dermatitis. I started using this stuff along with the doxycycline prescribed by my dermatologist, and my rash magically cleared up. What do you guys think worked on that? The mother of all creams or the doxycycline? And so our patients are just bombarded with all this stuff, and they're also really seeking natural therapies. It's kind of funny because when I see kids with molluscum, the bane of my existence, I will commonly talk about a natural therapy called Zymoderm that's tea tree oil based. Nobody chooses it. For eczema, all they want is natural. But for molluscum, they want like the biggest like atom bomb to just kind of destroy the little thing. I think I could market like arsenic or something for molluscum, or anthrax, put a little anthrax on it. Their biggest question would probably be like, does it work? And probably, it'll probably work. The trouble with natural therapies is that so few things actually get studied. And as a medical doctor, I want to recommend something that has been studied, that I know is safe, that I know is effective for my patients. And so it's often hard to come up with some natural fixes for people because we don't have the data. There are a few things that have been studied. So olive oil has been studied and worsens eczema. It should be avoided. Coconut oil has some good antibacterial properties. Doesn't seem to help the eczema itself very well. But again, it's all about flora. If they like it, I'm happy to have them keep using it. Sunflower seed oil does, in fact, tend to help eczema. There are good studies that show that. But it's very difficult to find a good preparation that doesn't have a whole bunch of other junk in it. There's an apothecary shop in Chicago called the Aroma Workshop that makes a nice version in a spray bottle. And so if people want to do that, that's the one I recommend. And then CBD oil probably does have some efficacy, especially for itch and maybe even in an anti-inflammatory way too. But again, difficult to find a good preparation. There is one that can be ordered online called Sequel that was formulated with the help of a pediatric dermatologist. So if my patients are interested in trying something like this, I recommend that. The Aaron regimen, moving on to some prescription therapies. How many people here have heard of the Aaron regimen? Yeah, a few. Those who haven't, this is going to change your practice right here, you guys. So the Aaron regimen was created by a dermatologist in the UK decades ago. People like that. It's European. And so you have you have the parents like right then and they're like, oh, European, okay, yeah. And Dr. Peter Leo kind of brought it back into relevance in the U.S. maybe 5-6 years ago. It's a compounded mix that contains betamethasone valerate, mupirocin, and then a moisturizing base, either vanicream if you want cream or plastibase if you want ointment. It makes a 1-pound tub. And you look at the amounts of the steroid and the antibiotic, it's just a teeny bit. It's a drop in the bucket. But something about this synergy, it works like magic, especially for kids under the age of 6, it is magical. Because of how diluted it is safe to use up to 5 times a day for bad flare-ups, taper with improvement, and it's safe to use every night at bedtime for prevention and maintenance. So it's one thing that patients can kind of turn up and turn down as they need to control their child's atopic dermatitis. And it works the best for babies and toddlers with that super prominent, persistent facial eczema that used to historically be so hard to get under control. The Aaron regimen does a great job. Couple before and after pictures. This is a 3-week follow-up. So this little boy's face, the same little boy's legs, the same little boy's tummy, and then this is the face of the Aaron regimen, you guys. This is 3 weeks. These kids with the really bad faces, the Aaron regimen is magic. And look how happy he is, cute little baby. Topical ruxolitinib. We talked about it for vitiligo. Let's talk about it for a moment for atopic dermatitis, especially with regards to its itch improvement. This was a poster at the RAD conference earlier this year where they looked at the time after application to see a decrease in itch if they noticed how quickly the itch decreased, and they found that by 15 minutes, patients were noticing a decrease in their itch, and it peaked at about 4 hours. And this is real. Like, I had a teenage patient text me the other day and say, oh my gosh, I just used topical ruxolitinib for the first time. Already I feel less itchy. I'm so happy. I really didn't want to do those shots or those pills you told me about, and I'm so happy this is helping me. And I replied and I was like, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. I'm so glad. I hope this works well for you. I included like 5 exclamation points about how happy I was for her. And she replied with K. Just K. Teenagers these days, you know? I also love combining topical Rux with dupilumab. I think it's a dynamic duo. Now, the label on topical Rux sometimes gets in the way because it says not to be combined with other systemic therapies, including biologics. And so a lot of times you have to fight with the insurance companies. What I've learned works the best is I just request a peer-to-peer and explain to them that that warning is only in there because it hadn't been studied that way in combination, and that I have a lot of clinical experience using these together. I find them to be a very safe, very very effective combination. And so usually with that conversation, they get approved. I also think it's the best thing I've found for the head and neck dermatitis associated with Dupi. And so I use quite a bit in combination. The burden of atopic dermatitis is huge, and I want to focus on three big things: sleep, growth disturbance, which are related, and an increased risk for other comorbidities like ADHD. So studies show that parents of kids with atopic dermatitis lose on average an hour to an hour and a half of sleep every night. I don't know about you guys, but I wouldn't be that pleasant to be around if I was losing an hour to an hour and a half of sleep every night. In addition, kids with bad atopic dermatitis don't sleep well. Even when they sleep, they don't sleep well. And they don't enter REM sleep as long or as often. And it's during REM sleep that their growth hormone is secreted. So physiologically, these kids have lower growth hormone. And we've all observed over the years that kids with bad atopic dermatitis tend to be small on growth curves. And finally, we have a physiologic reason why. In addition, growth hormone contributes to bone development. And we know that patients with AD have increased risk of osteoporosis, osteopenia, fractures. Finally, an explanation for why, and it all boils down to sleep. It's funny because sometimes I'm talking to patients and their families about the importance of treating the atopic dermatitis. It's always pertinent to talk about the side effects of the medicines that we're talking about, but there are side effects to not treating your child's atopic dermatitis, and I always will talk about the growth and the sleep thing. And it's funny, the growth thing really reaches people. When I say, you know, decreased growth, they're not going to grow as tall, they're like, no, we can't have a short child. And I try not to take offense to that because I am 5'1 and a half on a good day. And so I'm like, no, of course not. Of course not. Let's get them growing. Get them on treatment. There was also a great article in our Peds Derm Journal a couple of years ago looking at the effect of excess IL-4 on the developing brain. We've all observed that kids with bad atopic dermatitis have increased rates of ADHD, anxiety, depression, learning disabilities, autism spectrum disorder, and we thought, oh, it's just because they're itchy all the time, they just can't focus, all of that kind of stuff. Well, it turns out it might be the result of excess IL-4. That using mouse models, they found that excess IL-4 reduced myelination and leads to cognitive impairment in the mice. And so here we might have our kind of smoking gun link between the atopic dermatitis and these comorbidities. And if so, would this improve if we treated with something that inhibited IL-4? And I think the answer is yes. I've personally seen it in my practice. So through what was probably a computer glitch at Idaho Medicaid was covering Dupixent down to the age of 6 months for about a year and a half before the approval changed. The first time I learned this, I had this 2-year-old patient with horrible eczema, and I was like, I'm gonna fight Medicaid. This is worth my time. This kid's really struggling. I'm gonna fight Medicaid on this one. And we submitted the PA, and it was approved, just like that. I'm like, huh. And so then there was another patient who was almost as bad. And I was like, yes, this is worth fighting for. I'm gonna send in the thing for Dupixent. And we sent it approved, just like that. And then it was like floodgates were open. It was like, you get Dupixent, you get Dupixent, you get Dupixent. And so I saw all these kids that come into your office with bad eczema, and they are bouncing off the walls. They are pressing all the buttons. They are putting everything in their mouth. They are, you know, playing with the Emma iPad. They're doing all that kind of stuff. And then you put them on Dupixent, and they come back in, and they're just quietly coloring in the corner. I mean, it's amazing. This JAD study looked at older patients with eczema and with ADHD, and they looked at their use of ADHD meds before and after they were on Dupixent, and they found a marked reduction in the usage of ADHD meds once they were on Dupixent. So I think this is very real. The most common questions that I get for little kids going on Dupi, number one, how long will my child need to be on this? And I say, I don't know. When you're treating a 55-year-old man for atopic dermatitis, they're not outgrowing it. They'll be on the treatment on and on into the future. But it's different when you're treating a child. The child could outgrow it. It could become more mild with time. We just don't know how it's all going to play out. Let's focus on getting your kiddo better. Once they're all better, we can talk about increasing the time between the shots. So if they're on it every 4 weeks, let's try every 5 or every 6, those sorts of things. And if you're spacing out the Dupixent to every 10 weeks or so, and the person's doing okay, that's telling you it's okay to try to go without Dupixent. And so I leave that door open. I'm not asking them to commit their child to therapy for years and years and years, but I'm saying I truly don't know when we're going to come off of it, but we'll keep talking about that. Let's just focus on getting your kiddo better. What do we do about live vaccines? So, per label, non-live vaccines are okay. Non-live vaccines are okay. It's been studied with DTaP and meningococcal, and it's okay. Totally cool. Live vaccines per label are to be avoided. The two most common live vaccines are MMR and chickenpox, and they're given between the ages of 1 and 2, and again between the ages of 4 and 5. And so those are the windows of time where you have to be thinking about this. In the original trials, they would give the Dupixent, wait 3 months, give the vaccinations, wait 1 month, restart Dupixent. When the approval happened, I was trying to do that, but it was so hard to have these kids off drug for 4 months. And so what me and most peds derms do these days is we'll give the Dupixent, a month later they get their vaccinations, a month after that they restart Dupixent. So it's basically just skipping one shot. So that's what most of us are doing these days. And I'm honest with kids, so we're gonna talk about how to give kids the shots. A lot of my efforts are focused on showing that the ouch is worth it, you know? Like, yes, this shot hurts. I don't lie to kids. Dupi hurts. It does. It packs a punch. It's voluminous and it's thick. It's like molasses at times. And so I don't lie to them about that, but I point out just how worth it it is. So they're not going to like the shots, but they're going to like being able to sleep. They're going to like not being itchy. They're going to like being able to wear cool clothes. They're going to like having clear skin. And that 3 seconds of discomfort once a month for the young ones is going to make them feel better all the other seconds of all the other days. And that's what's important. So a couple tips for the shots. Number one, of course, take it out of the fridge at least an hour beforehand. Number two, a tip that I have found really helpful is to use the pen and inject the tummy. So I have the child lie down on the exam table, gently hold arms and legs, and then we use the pen and we treat the tummy. There's no way for them to wiggle that will hurt them or hurt me. And so it's a very effective strategy that I've used a lot and translates well to doing it at home too. Another technique that I utilize, particularly for the patients who are like 18 months to 3 years old, is something I call the HELP method, because Dupixent's going to help them. So the H stands for hug, the E stands for electronic device, the L stands for lollipop, the P stands for prize. So my staff knows if there's an 18 month to 3 year old coming in for a Dupi shot, before there's even a shot in the room, they get the child undressed. They have the parent get the child undressed. Because the last thing you're going to be allowed to do as you try to give a two-year-old a shot is get their clothes off. I'll tell you, those clothes are not coming off, you guys. So we just get the clothes out of the way right at the beginning. Then we have the parents start playing something fun on their phone or iPad. We get some Cocoa Melon up in there. We get some Paw Patrol. We get some Frozen. We're all letting it go and everything is fine. Then when it's time to do it, we have the parent sit in the chair with the child in their lap facing them in a hug. This exposes their upper outer arms and their upper outer thighs. So you have 4 injection site locations to choose from. Now it's go time. We have the electronic device playing. The child is in their hug. We put a lollipop in their mouth. We give their shot, and then it's clap, 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 prize box. Because the child will cry, but they recover quickly, especially if they can pick out a prize. 2 things I warn families about before I do the first shot. I say, number one, your child's gonna cry. That's okay, it's worth it. Number two, there will be a bump on their skin when we're done. Again, Dupi's a voluminous shot, and you're treating a little person. And so there's going to be a bump, which can freak the parents out if they're not expecting to see that. So those are the 2 most common techniques that I utilize in my clinic. Now, not all kids are immediately on board with this plan. This is Jackson. He was here in this picture for his very first Dupi shot. And he was nervous. And I was like, I know, bud, I know. And it's going to hurt for a second, but it's going to be so worth it. You're going to feel better. And so he got his first shot, and he cried, but they picked out a prize box, and he was doing good. Comes in a month later for his second shot, and his mom tells me, we have had our first month of peace since my child was born. I don't care if he cries. We're doing this. So we went ahead and gave him his second shot, and he was nervous, but he actually didn't cry. Third shot, he came in, my MA, Tony, gave it to him, and he turned to Tony and he said, thank you, Tony, for giving me my shot. Even at 5, Kids understand they feel better on this medicine. They might not be able to verbalize it eloquently, but they feel it and they know it. And so this was him the day of his third shot. Such a cutie. I want to return to my patient that this case is about. This is Bear. And so, like I told you, when Bear came in, he was just covered in eczema, miserable, 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 couldn't swim, couldn't play outside, really, really affected by his atopic dermatitis. I took one look at him, and I decided I was going to start him on Dupixent. And I turned to his parents, and I told them about it, and they were on board, too. And then I turned to Bear, and I said, hey, Bear buddy, you know, your eczema, it's real bad. He's like, I know. And we talked about how he couldn't swim and he couldn't play outside and how he really wanted to because he had two older brothers that he would like to do those things with. And I said, what if I told you that there was a medicine that I could put you on that would make you less itchy, would make your skin look better, would let you go outside and play, would let you go swimming? Wouldn't that sound like a good idea? And he said, yeah, that sounds really great. And I said, and what if I told you that that medicine was a shot and it's once a month? And he was like, I don't know about that. And I said, Bear, have you seen commercials for Dupixent? And he said, are those the ones where the kids take off the clothes that are the color of the background behind them? I said, yes, those are the ones. And he said, I'll do it if I can be on a commercial. And I said, okay, I will work on that for you, my friend. And so he let me give him his first Dupi shot that day. And then a month later, he came back in and he said, Dr. Watson, my skin doesn't shed anymore. And I went to San Diego with my family, and I was at SeaWorld all day outside. And I went swimming in the pool, and I went swimming in the ocean, and I went swimming in the hot tub. And when can I be on that commercial? And so you guys are going to see Bear on a commercial. Yeah? And you're going to see it, and you're going to be like, man, that potato girl from Idaho told us about that kid. Moving on to case number 6. This is Bella. So Bella's a 12-year-old girl with a lifelong history of atopic dermatitis. We had done all sorts of topicals, and then we did dupilumab. And at first, she did so awesome. She was on 200 milligrams every 2 weeks, and she did great. And then she just really started not doing great. And I increased the dose to 300 milligrams every 2 weeks. I optimized her topicals, talked to her about sensitive skincare, but still just couldn't turn the corner. And so we got her started on upadacitinib 15 milligrams. And when I saw her when things were this bad, her antecubital fossas were crusted shut. She couldn't extend her arms fully because they were crusted in the flexed position, so bad. So oral JAK inhibitors in a nutshell. We have upadacitinib and abrocitinib, both approved age 12 and up. Both have a starter dose with room to go up if you need to. These medicines offer rapid efficacy. They have itch data from day 2, rapid efficacy. You do have to consider their past medical history. What medical conditions do they have? What medicines are they on? Before you start the medicine, there is a real signal for increased cold sore virus and shingles. You do need to do labs, and you do need to talk about the box warning, and I'll tell you how I do that. We don't have a head-to-head of UPA versus ABRO, but we do have studies comparing each of the JAK inhibitors to Dupi. And we've known Dupi for 6.5 years. We know Dupi, we know what it provides. And so looking at these comparatives gives us a good sense for how these medicines would potentially even compare to each other. We also know how important itch improvement is. And these medicines work rapidly to decrease itch, which rapidly improves a patient's quality of life. This is looking at patients who achieved EASI 90. All of these people achieved EASI 90. And then we're looking at the percentage of patients who were able to achieve success when it came to quality of life measures based on how much itchiness improved. So you see, if you have an itch of 0 or 1, the darkest purple, you have a greater percentage of patients that are achieving these desirable quality of life measures. If you have itch NRS 2 to 3, that's not too bad, 2 to 3. The percentages of patients achieving these quality of life measures goes down. So we want to strive for itch 0-1 in our patients. The labs, I might do labs a little bit differently than some folks. I do quantiferon gold, hepatitis B, hepatitis C at baseline, and then I do CBC, CMP, lipid panel at baseline, month 1, then 3 months after that, then 6 months after that, and so on and so forth, because there can be some hematologic abnormalities that develop early on the first month, and so that's how I do it. Not everybody does it that way. Whenever I think about the box warning on these JAK inhibitors, I can't help but hear Taylor Swift's beautiful voice in my ear saying, "It's me. Hi, I'm the problem, it's me." Because these medicines would be flying off the shelves like Ozempic if it weren't for this boxed warning. And we need to educate ourselves on this warning so that we can talk to patients about it and get these patients on life-changing therapy. So my JAK inhibitor spiel, I tell patients there's three safety things about these medicines. Number one, we do have to do labs. Number two, there's an increased risk of cold sore virus and shingles. Do you get cold sores? Do you want to be vaccinated for shingles? And number three, there's a boxed warning that was based on a different oral JAK for a different patient population. And because of some safety concerns from that trial, the warning was placed on all the medicines. I've reviewed your past medical history and your medication list, and I think the benefits far outweigh the risks. This is Bella, before and after. Remember, she couldn't extend her arms the day that we started her on upadacitinib. And she's a chef, she cooks, she bakes, and she says now her aprons are dusted with flour rather than blood and crust from her atopic dermatitis. This is Wesley. Wesley's the little boy, 10 years old, who I started on UPA. He had no improvement with Dupi, so I started him off-label on upadacitinib. And he came back in at the one-month follow-up, and he said, "This medicine's great. I haven't felt this good in years." He's 10 years old. He's 10 years old. This is Violet. She's 13. We got her started on upadacitinib. She's a dancer. And shortly after, her mom sent me this email. Violet has been fighting her skin for as long as we can remember. She hasn't let her hold her back, but she has had to deal with comments from coaches and dance friends about her skin, and her confidence has suffered. Last week, Violet performed the spotlight performance for her dance crew in a dance that she self-choreographed. She got a standing ovation. "Thank you for making miracles happen." And as my eyes filled with tears, I replied, "Okay." Just kidding. I replied with several exclamation points. Understanding these JAK inhibitors is a journey. We're at the beginning of that journey. With real life experience and more study, we're going to get more and more comfortable. These medicines are too dang good to not be prescribing purely because of the boxed warning. This was a letter to the editor from Brett King and Britt Craiglow talking about just this. We can't give up on these JAKs because of the warning. We need to acknowledge these warnings, but we also need to focus on the wellness that these medicines can provide, because they really have unrivaled potential to help so many people. And look at all the wellness that these medicines can provide. A brief moment of reflection, and then I'll wrap up. I shared the wart case. The gentleman, the father, wanted me to freeze them because that's what he had done when he was a kid. And I told him about the other treatments, and he made me freeze them. And so I did, and the child cried. And he called back angry a couple months later that I hadn't done it right and the warts were still there. And I said, "Well, I told you, it takes multiple treatments, blah, blah, blah." Added him on a Saturday. Brought him in, went over the other treatments again, and he insisted that I refreeze them, but this time do it right. And he told his son that he was not allowed to cry. And so I went ahead and froze them, and then I get an angry call a couple months later because he didn't want to pay his copay, his $30 copay for what he called the warranty visit. Didn't want to pay his $30 copay. And after trying to talk to him, he was not really talk to-able, he said, "Here's the deal, Dr. Swanson. If you tell me I don't have to pay this copay, we'll hang up, you'll never hear from me again, all will be good. If you tell me I have to pay this copay, I'll mail the check, and then I'll go online and I'll blast you everywhere I see your name." And I said, and then he did it. Facebook, Google, Yelp, for all of my 5 Colorado locations, he did it. He blasted me. And I called his pediatrician, the kid's pediatrician, and I told him what had happened. And the pediatrician was such a pediatrician about it. He said, "He did that? What? What a butt." And I wanted to be like, I have other words that I would use. But it really, and so I felt like Taylor Swift, you are somebody that I don't know, but you're taking shots at me like it's Patron. And I'm just like, damn, it's 7 a.m. Because all I want to do is help people. But the joke is on him because I moved away from Colorado and those reviews are meaningless. I think about all the patients I've helped. I don't think about the wart guy unless I'm talking about him at a meeting like this. Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you.